This is Read On Air with Red Zell. For those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about reading that belongs to you. I'm your host Red Zell, and this week we'll be devouring some of today's most popular literary fiction. Jane Harris tells us why she thinks the 19th century makes the perfect backdrop for a suspense novel.
I do use characters I've met and events that have happened to me in my fiction, but because it's historical, nobody seems to even... It doesn't occur to them.
Until now. We hear how Dickensian publishing methods were used for the release of Julian Fellowes' Belgravia.
As a project, as a whole, it's fascinating and we're learning a lot. And I certainly think the readers are really enjoying it.
Alexander McCall-Smith tells Robert about updating a literary classic.
I had the best fun of my life. Since the Boy Scouts, so to speak. I mean, it really was absolutely wonderful fun.
And I try to fathom the profound impact of The Loney. That's all coming up in today's show. Jane Harris is the author of two hugely popular novels. Both The Observations and Gillespie and I are set in Victorian Britain and have been favourably compared to the writing of Wilkie Collins and Henry James. Her new novel, Sugar Money, is due to be published in October. Based on a little-known true story, it's described as a heartbreaking journey into the dark moments of our colonial past and a stunning act of literary ventriloquism that has earned her a major publishing deal with Faber. It's all rather exciting, so I was delighted when she found time to join me in the studio. Jane, welcome to Read On Air.
Hi.
It's out later in the year, but could you give us a little bit of insight into what Sugar Money is about?
Well, it might help to say where I actually came across the story. I was reading a history book about Grenada, because I've always been interested in Grenada, and I came across this tiny little snippet in this history book, just a paragraph or so, of a true story of something that happened in 1765 in Martinique and Grenada. And in the true story, which just I thought was so shocking and moving, basically some French monks who lived in Martinique but had been in Grenada previously hired what they called a mulatto slave to travel to Grenada, which was now in the hands of the English. So they'd recently been enemies, the English and the French. And he hired a mulatto slave to go to Grenada and steal around 40 slaves who had been left behind on the plantation that the fathers ran. Because although they were kind of mendicant monks and they ran hospitals and they were surgeons, quite a lot of them, in order to fund their good works, they ran plantations alongside the hospitals, which meant that they owned slaves, which seems really bizarre to us now. So that's what happened. They hired this poor guy who had no choice and he had to travel from Martinique to Grenada to basically steal these slaves and bring them back to Martinique with him. And I just thought, what an astonishing thing for him to have to do, and what an incredible story, because it's, I won't give too much away, but it's a real story about justice and injustice, and the original story is very moving.
Do you look for the parallels between our times and past times when you're writing?
I suppose the main thing that grabs me originally is an idea, or in this case, you know, the true story of what happened in the past. However, I am always sort of looking for comparisons with the present, and you know, throughout the writing process of Sugar Money, I could not help but be aware of, you know, the fact that people say, oh, slavery, it was so many hundred years ago, and actually it still exists today, you know, all around the world. And people say historical fiction is, you know, often not relevant, but there are so many parallels with today, and people being, you know, either sort of slaves themselves or paid slave wages, children enslaved in factories. All right. I mean, it's, you know, it couldn't be more relevant to today, I don't think.
And do you think historical fiction gives you the freedom to examine issues like that without being accused of standing on a soapbox and hitting a political drum?
That's interesting, yes, because always I try and I don't like to wear my ideas on my sleeve like badges. I kind of like to sort of hide them behind characters and a plot. So it does suit me quite well in that way to do historical fiction. However, you know, every time I finish a historical novel, I say, right, now I'm going to write a contemporary one. And then I always end up thinking, oh, what a great idea, what a great story that would be, and end up going back into history. But yes, it's a good way of smuggling things in. Also, you know, nobody ever accuses me of writing autobiographically, which contemporary writers must get accused of and are always complaining about. But nobody ever seems to do that when you're writing in history, even though I do use characters I've met and events that have happened to me in my fiction. But because it's historical, nobody seems to even... it doesn't occur to them.
Until now.
It was obvious that he lacked a circle of influence. The friends in high places that tend to make life easier for many artists. Poor Ned had no such advantage, and I had an inkling that he was neither mercenary nor calculating enough to cultivate influential or moneyed acquaintances. Before retiring that evening, I composed a letter to my stepfather, Ramsay Dalrymple, who resided just north of Helensburgh, a town not far from Glasgow. My feeling was that I ought at least to bring Ned to his attention. As far as I was aware, Ramsay was not particularly interested in fine art, but he was a wealthy man, and there was always the chance that he might be persuaded to buy a painting or two. Moreover, I felt that he was bound to be acquainted with some of the West of Scotland's establishment figures, perhaps even from within the art world itself, connections the like of which might prove useful to a young painter.
Not only is your fiction historical, it's also rather literary as well. I know you've been compared both to Henry James and to Wilkie Collins. And I was wondering if you feel that writers are only free to write great works of literary fiction if they're looking backwards to authors who have already been put into the canon of great literary writers.
I'm not sure about that. I probably don't think so. I know that for myself, I do read a lot of 19th century novels, probably more novels than history books, to be honest, because I find it a really easy, straightforward way to access that kind of the language, the detail of everyday life and that kind of thing. So, you know, I do read Wilkie Collins, Henry James, you know, I read Jane Austen, Dickens. And I find them, they do inform my work. But also, you know, I read contemporary novels as well. And I don't think you only have to read the classics or, you know, ancient works in order to be writing great literature. I would never even assume to say that I was writing great literature. You know, these comparisons with authors are kind of handy. They're a shorthand, aren't they? But sometimes they can be a little bit misleading.
I think they can, although actually I think they give the reader an excuse to pick up your book and start reading it. Anybody who likes Wilkie Collins is, I'd argue, going to love Gillespie and I, for instance.
Yeah,
or,
that's true.
Or The Observations. Mm. The period that you're dealing with between 1750 and, well, 1930, I suppose... Many of the characters, whether they're women or whether they're servants or slaves, are actually disenfranchised. Mm. Certainly in Gillespie and I, we have the wonderful protagonist, Harriet, who is a woman of independent means and a very independent mind. And yet, because she is a 30-something-year-old spinster, she is a woman of no consequence whatsoever, which is a very... disabling position to be in. Are you drawn towards characters who are disenabled from the society that they exist in?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think that's one thing that even when I was writing only short stories, I was tending to write about characters who sort of exist on the margins of society in some way, or who are disenfranchised, servants, women who, although they might have a bit of money, Harriet in particular, no, she does have money, but she's not only a spinster, but she's not a very attractive spinster. And you know, that puts her further outside of society. She's also an English woman in Scotland, which makes her very other. So, yes. And Bessie in The Observations is, you know, an Irish girl of the servant class and worse. And, you know, in this new book, it's it's poverty-stricken monks and slaves really are the characters. So, yeah, absolutely. I'm not really interested. When you say you write historical fiction, people often think you're writing about kings and queens and, you know, lords and ladies and, you know, famous events in history. That stuff doesn't really interest me, to be honest. I've always been more interested in social history and in the history that goes on behind, you know, the doors of the lower middle classes and the working class and the underclass. That's what really interests me, and that those are the stories that I find I want to tell.
There's a great sense, certainly in Gillespie and I, of the mechanism of society, which is designed to keep all the little cogs in their places. Mm. Again, you know, do you see parallels between that society and the society that we have now?
I don't know. When I was writing it, I very much disappeared, because I know that area of Glasgow really well, and I very much disappeared into my imagined notion of what that world was like. So, to be honest, in that book, I was sort of more, I don't know, trying to build it out of my imagined history of the place rather than drawing parallels. However, what is quite interesting about that book is that the very seed of that book, in fact, came from when I was thinking I wanted to write a contemporary book. And in the Guardian newspaper, I read about this court case that took place in, it was either Plymouth or Portsmouth. And it was a case about a woman who was a neighbour to a family, and the family had a little girl. And the little girl seemed to be behaving very badly. Things went missing, curtains were slashed, tranquilizers found their way into sort of a punch at a children's party. And this went on for months and months, and the girl's mother was going out of her mind, and she confided in the neighbour. And as it turned out, things were not quite as they seemed. And I thought, what an incredible story that is. And actually, I've just remembered that is where Gillespie and I came from. So again, that was based on a true story. So there you go. So very, a complete parallel. And actually, what happened was, when I read that article, I thought, I'll do that as a contemporary story. And then I decided, no, what I'm going to do is, because it could perfectly well happen in the 19th century, I'm going to set it in this art world, which also quite interests me, the sort of turn of the century art world in Glasgow. So I mixed those two things together, and that's how, that's how that story came about.
Oh, fantastic. It's a very successful blend. I must say, reading both your books that have been published, I get the impression that you must be surrounded by reference books. And it was interesting to hear that you prefer to read fiction rather than history books, because your attention for detail is phenomenal and also very pleasing. You know, I like to feel I've learnt something when I've read a book, or pick up some nice phrases. I love the phrase ink slinger that you use for journalists.
Oh yes, that's right. Yeah.
I suppose you've got the writer's magpie mind that picks these things up.
I absolutely do, and I am surrounded by reference books always. You know, I tend to buy books secondhand rather than go to the library, because I don't really like working in the library. So I'm always surrounded by, I've got sort of two bookshelves that are always full of my Touchstone books for each novel. And I read them, you know, obsessively. And I'm also always looking at maps and pictures and photographs. The trick is that when you come to write it, you then have to, you know, hide the research. So you have to be able to, rather than, you know, have your character notice a clock on the mantelpiece and describe it for no reason whatsoever, which sometimes happens in historical novels, I have to try and think, well, what actually would this character be noticing, and only mention the things that the character would notice, and only put in details that the character would notice, and try and, give the effect of the, you know, historical context without going overboard. Sometimes it's enough to even just mention a candle in a room. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But you have to lose the research. And also, one other thing is that I've got a brain the size of a walnut. So after I've read something, I instantly forget it. So I need to make notes all the time. And then the notes, you know, end up in enormous box files. And some of that goes into the novel, some of it is eventually discarded. But if people ask me questions about the history, you know, say 2 years after a book has been written, I can barely remember the characters' names, never mind. Never mind what book, you know, what where did you get that bit of research from? So it's probably just as well. It has to pass through my brain and get down into the novel fairly quickly, otherwise it's lost for all time.
I had no idea that such tensions lurked beneath the surface. For some reason, feelings of vague disquiet and a sense of foreboding welled up inside me. This skirmish between Elspeth and Annie, and now between Annie and Ned, and all caused essentially by Sybil, seemed destined to escalate out of control. It felt somehow preordained, even irreversible.
And are you, you're a visual researcher, are you? You don't listen to audiobooks or audio history to glean your research?
Actually, that's a very good point. I tend to listen to audio novels, but not audio history. I'm very inspired by maps in particular.
And do you use the map as your conduit to walk into the world and then you just inhabit that world whilst you're writing?
Yes, I think so, definitely. I mean, there's a lot of old maps of Grenada and I sort of stare at them endlessly. Also, there is a journey in Sugar Money as well, so that was very important for that purpose as well, using the old maps. But I did walk the route of the journey that is taken as well to get the things of the senses, the smells, the textures, what you can see from what position and all that kind of thing.
Which just goes to show that researching a novel can be fun, I suppose. It's
well, yes, it was fun.
It's not all lonely garret stuff.
Yes, no, it was great. Yes, and unfortunately on that trip you can't get directly to Grenada, so I had to go via Barbados.
Oh, hardship, terrible hardship.
Yeah.
So you said you listened to audio novels. Have you ever listened to either of the audiobook versions or talking book versions of your books?
Well, I did listen to the first one because I recorded it myself. And that was an interesting experience in a studio not much bigger than this one. It took a whole week and I was arrogant enough at the time to think nobody can possibly do all the accents that need to be done in this book. I will have to do it myself. But at the end of the week, I was so exhausted. I thought, I'm never doing this again. Now I know why actors are paid to do their job. It's absolutely exhausting. So I know that one very well. Mm-hmm. And I have listened to, not all of, but I've listened to part of the Gillespie and I one. And I was very pleased with that. I think Anna did a very, very good job. And she got the accents brilliantly. Mm.
So what is the due date for publication for Sugar Money?
I believe it's the 5th of October. It was going to be next year, but for some reason they brought it forward, which I'm told is a good thing. And there will be an audiobook, definitely, because I've already signed the contract for that, so that's cool.
Wonderful. And Faber is certainly one of those publishers who likes to publish simultaneously, so we'll all be able to enjoy it together.
Yep.
Well, Jane Harris, thank you so much for joining us in the studio and giving us a sneak preview of Sugar Money and talking about your two other wonderful novels.
Thank you. It was an absolute pleasure.
My thanks to Jane Harris. Both The Observation and Gillespie and I are available from the RNIB Library, the latter as TB18842. You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, and we'll have more after this.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print, and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
Like many readers, I got hooked on Julian Fellowes's Belgravia last year. Each week brought an eagerly anticipated new chapter, as the novel was serialised simultaneously in e-text and audio. Access to both was free to RNIB members. Serialisation was the favoured method of publication for many of the Victorian novelists, including Charles Dickens and Wilkie Collins. Robert Kirkwood talked to the team behind Belgravia to find out more. But first, here's an extract.
The past, as we have been told so many times, is a foreign country where things are done differently. This may be true, indeed it patently is true, when it comes to morals or customs, the role of women, aristocratic government, and a million other elements of our daily lives. But there are similarities, too. Ambition, envy, rage, greed, kindness, selflessness, and above all, love, have always been as powerful in motivating choices as they are today.
That's Juliet Stevenson reading from Julian Fellowes' Belgravia. Joining me to tell me more are Marissa Hussey, the Digital Development and Technical Director at Orion, and Susan Howe, who's the Rights, Audio and Digital Director. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Thank you.
Now, tell us about the story itself.
It's very much a wonderful sort of period drama, the sort of thing that Julian Fellowes does so brilliantly. It's historical. It's set in the early 19th century on the eve of the Battle of Waterloo. And the first episode has the most amazing scene of the ball prior to the battle. And we meet some of our key characters.
His Royal Highness, the Prince of Orange.
A pleasant-looking young man approached the host and hostess, and the Duchess, her back as straight as a ramrod, plunged into a deep court curtsy. The Duke of Wellington did not arrive much before midnight, but he was cool enough about it when he did. To James Trenchard's intense delight, the Duke looked about the ballroom, and on spotting him, walked over.
At the end of that episode, and it's all done in true wonderful Julian Fellowes style, we're left on a real cliffhanger because one of our major characters has seen something that's truly shocked her, and we don't know why. And then we're led in then to the start of the story proper. That's very much the prologue. And we fast forward 25 years. And then it develops from there, really, in the way that Julian Fellowes, the master of that period drama, develops the characters, the family dramas, the social climbing, which is wonderful because it was such a period of change and all the new merchants coming through and are really upsetting the aristocratic classes. And he does all of that beautifully. And, of course, his dialogue is second to none. So I don't want to give too much away, but that's roughly how it goes.
Well, if it isn't the magician!
Richmond beamed quite jovially. If he was surprised to find this tradesman in his drawing room, you could not have told it.
Do you remember we made some plans in the event of the reservists being called to arms? I recall it very well. Your schedule, I mean, Duke.
And tell us why you decided to release it in the way it was released.
We were really, as a company, I mean, I think publishing is facing many challenges at the moment with all sort of technology. I mean, like all industries, it's been very much disrupted, and we're always looking for the new and how we continue to reach our audience and our readers effectively. And I think we had a bit of a brainstorming and decided that the Charles Dickens idea of the serialization worked incredibly well when it did, and whether there was something that we could do and give it a sort of 21st century makeover. And it's been very interesting. We have had a lot of people who clearly like to binge read and are saving the episodes, but others who, we get such amazing feedback on social media, others who are very, very keen and waiting literally for that Thursday morning for the new episode to be released. So I think that was where the idea came from, really. It was, how can we reach the audience? How can we do something different? And as part of that, we also wanted to offer more than just a straightforward story. So we looked at other areas of the market, and one of the big areas for us that's changing and growing and has been grown dramatically in the last 3 years is the audio area. And for this reason, we decided that we'd focus very much on the audio and release that as part of the story at the beginning, ahead of the print version. All of the episodes are released digitally along with the audio. And on top of that, we've also looked at a raft of big range of extra content, which backs up the story, some historical facts, some facts around the fashions of the time, the customs of the day, the history. So some sort of context for the story, which we're finding that readers are also really, really enjoying. So our focus has been around the story, the audio, and this, the extra content.
Ladies in Belgravia, they don't have a job, but they are fully occupied in getting changed all day. They have a series of changes of costumes, costumes so complicated that they need their ladies' maid to help them, and sometimes even more people as well.
So was it written with the episodic nature in mind?
It certainly was, and that in itself was a really exciting, an adventure, as Julian Fellowes likes to call it. He worked very, very hard on each chapter. We had a team, actually, in the end, who worked with him. He did the Bible, as it were, and all the storylines. And as they do in television, we had a historical consultant and someone else who came along and did some of the work. And Julian very much took it in hand and then went over it, introducing his amazing dialogue. So it was written with that in mind, but the whole idea at the end was that we would release it as a novel as well.
Now, Marissa, how much work goes on at the back end of a project like this?
Well, we have been working on this for about a year. This was brand new in a lot of ways. We didn't have any structure for releasing content direct to consumers. The e-commerce aspects that needed to be built all needed to be built from scratch. And then even just the technology around the reading and the listening, we've tried to replicate much more established e-readers and audio listening applications in a really, really short span of time. So that's all been very challenging.
And it's incredible the fact that you can read the print version on whatever device you have and then just press a button and it starts reading it to you as well.
Yep. And we found that so far a lot of people have really liked that option, which we expected, and it's why we chose to create the product as both the text and the audio edition.
Now, Julian Fellowes himself, he's confessed that he's not very tech savvy. Can he use the app?
Yes, I think he undersells himself. Absolutely. I handed him my iPad and he was off. He knew exactly what to do.
Now, you've got Juliet Stevenson narrating the audio version. Were you pleased to get her?
We were so delighted when she accepted the invitation because her audience is perfect for this project. And she read it so beautifully. I mean, the way she brought the characters to life, the way she manages to do the male voices in particular, I mean, it was just stunning.
Have you got it?
His excitement was palpable. There was something charming in his enthusiasm, this plump, balding master of business who was suddenly as excited as a child on Christmas Eve. Very slowly, squeezing the last drop out of the moment, Sophia opened her reticule and carefully removed some squares of white pasteboard.
I have three,
she said, savouring the occasion. One for you, one for Mama, and one for me.
Now, RNIB are releasing the audio version at the same time as yourselves via our RNIB Overdrive library, and it's proved very popular there. What about in the wider world?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we've noticed is that there are, I think as I referred to slightly earlier, is there are a core number of people who absolutely cannot wait to read the next episode, which is exactly what we wanted to do. So all the people that have signed up to the website or signed up to Facebook, we're in touch with them. And it's a very, very interesting. It's very interesting seeing what their reaction is and what people respond to, whether it's certain characters, whether it is the audio. We can test and measure all this sort of thing. So as a project as a whole, it's fascinating and we're learning a lot. And I certainly think the readers are really enjoying it.
Will you follow up maybe with even a sequel to Belgravia or perhaps a different book and author?
Well, that is the intention, that we would do a sequel. But I think the way that we've developed the technology that sits behind the website and the app, the idea was very much so that we could do other projects or other books, or whether it's non-fiction or science fiction or fantasy, or establish where our audience might be for this type of approach.
So, Marissa, the next book will be a lot easier to do than this one.
I hope so. As Susan says, this was built with the intention of creating a framework and creating a structure that we could use going forward, and that this would be something that changed our business. So that was a focus for us all along the way and during the development, is that this is something that could continue to grow and continue to be useful to people and exciting for us. You know, one of the most exciting things is the bonus features within the text, and then also if you're listening to the audio, you can go and view them separately. It's kind of an inherent second screening. So, you know, we know that people are, while they're listening or while they're watching something, are going to go look for more information. And we've kind of presented that within the experience, which we think is another really exciting thing, that people will continue to do that, and the more information we can provide, the better and the more fun the experience.
So this is the morning dress, so Anne might wear this from about 9 to about 12. Then she'd probably have a luncheon meeting, so she set off in her luncheon dress. This is a more formal engagement dress. Men might see her. Then in the afternoon, it's afternoon tea dress. That's just for ladies, but we know what ladies are like.
Now, how important is the audio format so your books are accessible to everyone?
It's very important, and it's an area that we see great potential. And one of the interesting things that we're looking at is widening what we actually put into audio. And obviously now with the downloadability, it's meant that as publishers, we can look at a wide range of audio of titles that previously we could never have published in audio because they would be too long, too expensive, and the market wasn't there. But now with the download market, we're seeing a range of titles selling in a way that they didn't before, and a real take-up in audio for all sorts of non-fiction, history, business books, health books. We've even been looking at some cookery titles, so we're really widening it, and I think that's very important, and we'd love to be working more with the RNIB on those sort of titles.
Now, talking of RNIB, if someone who's listening to Belgravia via RNIB Overdrive and wants some of those extra features, how accessible is it?
Part of our testing process and, you know, making sure that everything was sort of ready to bring the product to market was testing accessibility and every possible thing that could be broken or how people access this application, and, you know, testing to make sure it works. So even if you are listening via Overdrive, if you want to download the app is free to download, and you can still sort of experience all of the bonus features and things like that around the first episode, because that is free in the app. So you can listen to it there, of course. You can explore the map of Belgravia as long as you have the correct keyboard turned on your phone or your iPad or whatever device you have. Everything will be read aloud to you, and it's a pretty good experience.
Now, if anyone wants to find out more and they're online, where can they go?
They can go to www.julianfellowsbelgravia.com. Alternatively, just searching Belgravia or Julian Fellows Belgravia will get you to where you need to go.
Marissa Hussey and Susan Hout, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks to Robert. Let's hope for many more such serialisations. As well as giant print and braille versions, Julian Fellowes' Belgravia is also available as TB number 23163. Another author whose books have been serialised is Alexander McCall Smith. Robert Kirkwood found out more about his wide-ranging literary career.
Alexander McCall Smith is one of the RNIB libraries and the world's most prolific and popular authors. He's had a varied career. A professor of medical law, he worked in universities in the UK and abroad. Then, after the publication of his highly successful number one ladies detective agency series, which has sold over 20 million copies, he devoted his time to the writing of fiction. Amongst others, he's penned The Sunday Philosophy Club, the Corduroy Mansion novels, and the Scotland Street novels. There are also collections of short stories, academic works, over 30 books for children, and with authors like Val McDermott and Joanna Trollope, he's recently inhabited the world of Jane Austen as part of the project to rewrite her works as contemporary novels. I chatted to him about all of the above, but he didn't start writing as a career until he was in his 50s. So first of all, I asked him why he waited so long.
Yes, I did write when I was younger, and I suppose I started writing in a reasonably serious way in my late 20s, but it was part-time, it was in my spare time. And I wrote quite a number of children's books. I wrote about 30 children's books before I started to write adults fiction. And then there was a period of a few years when I suppose the books were reasonably kindly reviewed, but they hadn't really taken off, and then they took off, and that enabled me to make the decision to be a full-time writer.
Is it important to have some experience behind you before you put pen to paper?
Well, I think it's useful. It's not absolutely essential, because there are people who write books that are very interesting and seem to be very wise, even if they're very young. I think the exception. Generally speaking, I think you probably acquire a certain knowledge of the world and a certain feeling for the world as you get longer in the tooth. And I think that it is useful to have done something else if you're a writer. because that brings to the process a different sort of experience.
Now, as a serial novelist, what is it about your characters that you just have to keep revisiting them again and again?
Well, I think it's a great privilege and pleasure being a serial novelist because you know the characters. Therefore, when you write the next novel in the series, you don't really have to invent the characters again. You're familiar with them, and the readers like that. The readers like encountering a character whom they already know. So it's rather like sitting down with an old friend rather than making a new friend every time. So that's a great pleasure.
And another use of the word serialisation, are you experimenting with the way you're delivering the novels by releasing them chapter at a time?
Yes, I've done that. I write a serial novel called the Scotland Street series. I'm currently writing the 10th volume in that series, and that is a serial novel in the true sense, in that the chapters are published as I write them. So every day for quite a number of months, a chapter appears in the Scotsman newspaper Monday to Friday. And I'm usually a little bit ahead of myself, so I will usually have about 5 to 10 chapters written in advance of the publication of any particular chapter. But the book is certainly not finished while it's being published. And that, of course, means that you can't change it in the way in which an author normally can finish a manuscript and then go back and revisit it, tweak it, etc., and then publish it. So that involves rather different considerations.
Mara Motswe had a detective agency in Africa, at the foot of Kali Hill. These were its assets: a tiny white van, 2 desks, 2 chairs, a telephone, and an old typewriter. Then there was a teapot, in which Mara Motswe, the only lady private detective in Botswana, brewed Redbush tea. And 3 mugs, one for herself, one for her secretary, and one for the client. What else does a detective agency really need?
Well, we're sitting off mic. We have a mutual friend in Gary Kagan who's read many RNIB talking books and has his own audio production company, The Story Circle, that do your books. How important is that relationship to the finished audiobook?
Yes, I've got a number of audio versions, and The Story Circle has certainly been one of my publishers. We have quite a number of different audio people we use for different countries. So I've got a different company in the United States and Canada. Then I've got one of them is in Australia, and so on. I think it's useful to have a continuing relationship with an audio publisher because they know what sort of thing you like. I very much enjoy the audio versions of my books. I like audiobooks myself. I listen to audio books on my iPod. For example, I'm currently working my way through the audio versions of Patrick O'Brien's wonderful naval historical novels. And audiobooks are just a great glory for everybody, not just for those who need to have them, but everybody can enjoy them. I find it interesting how they choose the readers. They usually will run the reader past me. They'll send me a sample of how the reader sounds. I tend not to interfere in their choice, although every so often I have to say, well, look, you know, there are considerations here that you should bear in mind. Mm-hmm. And so I did have one of my books, which was set in Edinburgh, read by a Glasgow actor and actress, and of course the editors were down in London, so they didn't know
Scottish.
They didn't, yeah, exactly, and so they didn't know that Glasgow and Edinburgh are separate places. So I had to tell them.
Henry Woodhouse, known to most as Mr. Woodhouse, did not follow the career that had been expected of generations of young Woodhouses. While his father had assumed that his son would farm, in an entirely gentlemanly way, the 600 acres that surrounded their house, Hartfield, the young man had other plans for himself.
Now, you've reworked Jane Austen along with some other Scottish novelists. How was that process?
I enjoyed writing Emma, which is the one they gave me to rework. I absolutely loved it. I accepted that with absolutely no hesitation, 40 seconds of profound thought, and I said, yes, I'm on for that. And I had the best fun of my life since the Boy Scouts, so to speak. I mean, it really was absolutely wonderful fun. And at the end, I felt bereft when I finished it, because I so enjoyed being in the world of those characters. I loved doing it. Now, of course, you have to be careful about reworking the classics, because you're stepping into the lion's den. There are people who say Jane Austen doesn't need to be rewritten, that sort of thing. But I think most people seem to find the idea of this Jane Austen project, where they invited various people to write new versions, including, as you say, Val McDermott did one. I think that's fine.
A lot of the drama in that book is the waiting for a letter to arrive, but in the days of instant communication, how did you overcome that?
Well, that's interesting. I did have them cell phones, and I think they had texts and things like that. But I didn't make much of that. And so I put the characters in the countryside. I debated with myself as to whether I should actually transfer the whole novel to Scotland. And I thought of putting Emma in Tobermory. But I thought that that would be an act of cultural expropriation, in that we would be very cross if somebody took, say, kidnapped and put it down in England. So I kept it in England, and I put it in a rural part of England, in Norfolk. Now, I know the original doesn't happen there, but the original will now be covered with motorways and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so the characters are living in the countryside. They go from house to house in cars. So Emma has a little Mini Cooper. Mm-hmm. And so we've got the new technology, but I still wanted to convey the sense of space, mental space, emotional space that you find in Jane Austen. So I still had them not doing very much, because Jane Austen's characters don't really do very much, so nobody was very busy.
I feel we're drawing this out somewhat. The point is that it would be a very fine thing if you chose to farm rather than to be... What was it you wanted to be? A design engineer. This was greeted with silence. I see.
A clip from Emma, a modern retelling by Alexander McCall Smith, narrated there by Georgina Terry. There are many books by Alexander McCall Smith in the Talking Books Library. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
Thanks to Robert and to Alexander McCall Smith. His modern retelling of Emma is TB22234.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss, and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Welcome back to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio. If there's enough buzz about a book, it will usually become a bestseller. Such was the case with The Loney by Andrew Michael Hurley. Only 300 copies were printed when it was first published in 2014, but it quickly gained a reputation among literary circles, so that its re-release a year later received quite a fanfare. It went on to win the 2015 Costa First Novel Award, as well as that year's British Book Industry, Best Debut Fiction and Book of the Year prizes. Seemingly, it achieved that rare balance of being both literary and popular, and soon everyone was talking about it. The story begins with the discovery of a child's body after a landslide on the island of Cold Barrow, near Morecambe Bay, a stretch of coast known as the Loney.
If it had another name, I never knew. But the locals called it the Loney, that strange nowhere between the Wyre and the Loon, where Hanny and I went every Easter time with Mumma, Father, Mr. and Mrs. Belderboss, and Father Wilfred, the parish priest. It was our week of penitence and prayer, in which we would make our confessions, visit St. Anne's shrine, and look for God in the emerging springtime that, when it came, was hardly a spring at all. Nothing so vibrant and effusive. It was more the soggy afterbirth of winter.
Knowing there'll be an investigation, the unnamed narrator sets down his version of events, taking the reader back to those Easter pilgrimages of his youth in the 1970s. It's a haunting, atmospheric tale that has an otherworldly feel about it. Both the landscape and the era are remote and shrouded in mist. Led by their parish priest, Father Bernard, the small band of pilgrims head into the wilderness, seeking a miracle to cure the narrator's older brother, Hanny, of his muteness. The two boys have developed a form of sign language and a close bond. In an inversion that's typical of the book, the narrator is very much the one looking after his older brother. But while the boys are happy to play amid the sand dunes, the adults hope and pray that God will reward their acts of faith by healing Hanny. None is more rigid in their devotions than the boy's mother, who's still guided by the example of Father Bernard's predecessor, a fire and brimstone preacher who returned from their last pilgrimage to the Loney a broken man. By contrast, Father Bernard is wonderfully humane. His previous parish, in Belfast at the height of the Troubles, has convinced him that there are only versions of the truth. Moreover, he believes that God is to be loved rather than feared, which doesn't go down well with the boy's mother. Questions of theology ebb and flow through the book. Its pages are filled with religious imagery and symbols of sacrifice, but underlying it all are hints of a more ancient, atavistic power lurking in the landscape, leaving the reader unsure as to whether this is a holy place or a God-forsaken one. The narrator is equally uncertain of his ground. Swept by adolescent doubt, his bedrock of belief turns to shifting sands as perilous as those of the Loney. Hurley has said that he set out to write a kind of dark version of the Nativity, also that he wanted to explore in ideas of faith and belief a sense of imminent menace and dormant power lying just below the sand and the water. That sense of menace is reinforced by a fantastically macabre cast of characters who could have stepped straight out of a Hammer horror film. There's a gruesome trio of suspicious locals, a mysterious rich couple with a pregnant child, and the obligatory screaming female. Strange things happen, and the supernatural seems altogether possible.
I'd never liked the look of Thessaly. And even though in the past we had always been under strict instructions never to cross the sands to Cold Barrow, we wouldn't have gone there anyway. There were stories, naturally, of it being haunted. A witch had once lived there, they said, a beautiful woman called Elizabeth Percy, who lured sailors onto the rocks, and who remained there in some form or other, even though they'd hanged her in the old bell tower next to the house.
Hurley writes beautifully, and his control of pace and atmosphere is masterful. It's a truly compelling read, but I have to confess it left me feeling unsatisfied. Too much was left unexplained, and I came away wondering whether I'd missed the point or a few pages somehow. What explanation there was seemed rather contrived. I'm certainly glad I read the book, and others may well find more meaning in it than me. But ultimately, it felt more like a highly polished exercise in creative writing than a great novel. The Loney by Andrew Michael Hurley is available in various accessible formats from the R&IB Library, including as TB23005. Do you have a book that you think would expand my reading horizons? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Yvonne Milne is not only studio manager for RNIB Connect Radio, but also a familiar and much-loved voice on the station. In her spare time, she likes nothing better than to curl up with a good novel. So I was delighted when she agreed to share the books of her life. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on. I'm delighted to be here.
So I like to ask my guests for the books of their lives. Typically, they start off with a book that they read as a child or younger person that made you fall in love with reading.
Oh, that's a really good question about the first book. I think the one for me, quite unoriginally actually read, would be To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. And it was a book I took out off the library at my school. And it was one of those books I knew I probably should read because I'd heard it was a classic. And for months I had it in the bottom of my school bag and I kept renewing it. And I kept trying the first two or three pages and thinking, this is really boring. And then something just made me keep going. And as soon as I was through about the first couple of chapters, I was absolutely hooked by the world of Jem and Scout. And I just love it. And I read it actually very recently again. And it just stands up to being reread again and again.
When he was nearly 13, my brother Jem got his arm badly broken at the elbow. When it healed, and Jem's fears of never being able to play football were assuaged, he was seldom self-conscious about his injury. His left arm was somewhat shorter than his right. When he stood or walked, the back of his hand was at right angles to his body, his thumb parallel to his thigh. He couldn't have cared less, so long as he could pass and punt. When enough years had gone by to enable us to look back on them, we sometimes discuss the events leading to his accident. I maintain that the Yules started it all. But Jem, who was 4 years my senior, said it started long before that. He said it began the summer Dill came to us, when Dill first gave us the idea of making Boo Radley come out.
And the second of the books that resonate with our guests' lives tends to be something that they'd like to curl up with on the sofa on a rainy day with nothing better to do.
Oh, so for me, probably one of the books I love is The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje. Oh. I came to it via the film. I watched the film and loved the film. I found it, you know, a great film and thought, I'll read the book. And actually the book is incredibly different from the film in the perspective it takes. And so I found that quite fascinating how they've changed. Really, the main character is really Kip in the book, and they've kind of gone with the love story a bit more in the actual film. But the language that Michael Ondaatje uses and the symbolism and the metaphor is just so beautiful. It's such a simple, it's written so simply, and yet it's incredibly dense. And the themes that are involved in the book are just stunning. So I really love it because it's not actually what I'd call, you know, particularly, I'm not up for really difficult reads anymore. You know, I just want something that's quite accessible, and yet there's so many layers to it. And every time I read it, there's another layer to it. And I just love it.
She stands up in the garden where she has been working and looks into the distance. She has sensed a shift in the weather. There is another gust of wind, a buckle of noise in the air, and the tall cypresses sway. She turns and moves uphill towards the house, climbing over a low wall, feeling the first drops of rain on her bare arms. She crosses the loggia and quickly enters the house. In the kitchen, she doesn't pause, but goes through it and climbs the stairs, which are in darkness, and then continues along the long hall, at the end of which is a wedge of light from an open door. She turns into the room, which is another garden, this one made up of trees and bowers, painted over its walls and ceiling. The man lies on the bed, his body exposed to the breeze, and he turns his head slowly towards her as she enters.
And is there another book that you've read recently that has rewarded you as a reader that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yeah, I think, again, another book that I absolutely love and have read a couple of times now, and again quite recently, was The Time Traveller's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger. it's such a bizarre story and it dots about all over the place. And it's a little bit sci-fi, actually. But what I love about it is that it deals mainly with normality and the normality of a relationship and being part of a family under very strange circumstances of this person that kind of time travels. And I love that it kind of looked at the domestic as much as the kind of the weirdness of this man's existence and the existence of the family. And it's such a beautiful romance, actually. And you know, just very poignant.
And I think it has an awful lot to say about different ability or disability. You know, as you say, the fact that the hero is trying to lead as normal a life as possible, despite having rather a life-changing condition.
Yeah, I think at first I didn't like the character. I wasn't very sure if I liked him. And just sort of seeing how he's coping with the fact that he time travels, and he doesn't really want to time travel at all, and the sort of odd situations that he ends up in, just really resonated with me, and the relationship with his wife, Claire, and how they come, you know, to be together. It's just stunning. It's just a stunning book. And it's one of those ones that you wonder if when you read it again, are you going to find holes in the plot? Because it doesn't quite add up. But I have never... It all hangs together beautifully and very poignantly. I just found that just a really interesting read.
Sometimes you feel as though you have stood up too quickly, even if you're lying in bed half asleep. You hear blood rushing in your head. Feel vertiginous falling sensations. Your hands and feet are tingling, and then they aren't there at all. You've mislocated yourself again. It only takes an instant. You have just enough time to try to hold on, to flail around, possibly damaging yourself or valuable possessions, and then you are skidding across the forest green carpeted hallway of a Motel 6 in Athens, Ohio, at 4:16 a.m., Monday, August 6th, 1981, and you hit your head on someone's door, causing this person, Ms. Tina Schulman from Philadelphia, to open this door and start screaming because there's a naked, carpet-burned man passed out at her feet.
My thanks to Yvonne. All of her chosen titles are available in various accessible formats from the RNIB library. And if you'd like to share the books of your life, why not drop us an email via the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. So that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and all of you who've been in touch about your book groups, the titles you've been enjoying, and your ideas for books that I should read. Next week, we'll be getting intimate with some great love stories. In the meantime, if you've any suggestions for future shows or want to get in touch about anything you've heard or read, I'm just an email away. Until then, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.